KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. A technology called LIDAR has helped archaeologists confirm the location of an ancient Cambodian city. We're going to hear more about it later this hour from NBC Science editor Alan Boyle. And after 10 o'clock, our journalist panel talks about everything from the Paris Air Show to the Seattle mayor's race. And of course, Stan Freeberg's our guest this hour. Yesterday, the U.S. House of Representatives surprised a lot of people when it failed to reauthorize a farm bill. Some political observers say the bill's failure is more evidence of hardened political ideologies that don't condone compromise in any form. Joining us to talk more about the defeat of the farm bill is Todd Zwillich. He's Washington correspondent for The Takeaway. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, Marcy.
What actually did happen yesterday in the House?
A disaster. A legislative disaster is what happened, especially from the standpoint of the House Republican leadership. Farm bills, Marcy, have always passed, usually passed with pretty broad bipartisan support because so many states and districts across the country have a stake. I mean, every single state in the country has farms, and most of those farms have something to gain in the farm bill, not to mention 47 million people across the country who use food stamp and food stamps and other nutritional benefits. So the cities have a stake in the farm bill. The rural areas have a stake in the farm bill. So usually it passes. This is not usual, this congressional situation that we're in. And I know you already know that. But yesterday that was brought into stark relief. The farm bill already failed once before last year. It didn't fail on the floor, but they couldn't put it on the floor because they couldn't get they couldn't get enough votes to pass it. And they tried again, and they tried to put together a coalition of Republicans and Democrats. A lot of Republicans won't vote for this bill because they think it spends too much. $940 billion just flat out spends too much, and they wanted to cut food stamps. They got some cuts in food stamps, and Democrats bolt when that happens. So they put together a coalition, and eventually it fell apart.
Well, some of the things that I was reading about had nothing to do with money, and they had a lot to do with sort of philosophical amendments that were added to the bill.
Yeah, that's true. And a lot of this happened towards the end. There was a lot of work done in the committee to try to put together this coalition that I discussed of Republicans and Democrats that could pass this bill. Once it got on the floor, Republicans started insisting on a couple of additional things. There were some changes to the way dairy subsidies are structured. And that sounds really boring. And maybe it is if you're not a dairy farmer. But when you do that, if somebody does have dairy farms in their district in upstate New York or something like that, or in Minnesota or Wisconsin, certainly, and they're a Democrat, they don't want that program change. They might have been willing to go with you, but they're not going to vote for it. And then something even much more important happened. Republicans, many of them conservatives, started insisting on more changes to the food stamp program that would have added new work requirements, that would have allowed some states to shave the value of food stamp benefits, and would have also not defined how states use the money that they save. So a lot of Democrats got worried that a state could in effect cut food stamps and spend the money, you know, somewhere else on highways or whatever you want. And when that happened, to get more Republicans on board, Democrats said, no way, you're not going to make this more draconian. And they just couldn't put together the numbers.
Well, you know, it's fascinating because we hear out here where we live in Washington state that the whole thing is about budget cutting. It's about reform, making things leaner, meaner, and tighter. But it sounds as if by adding these philosophical amendments to this bill that we moved beyond mere budget discussion. I don't mean mere, but it wasn't about money necessarily.
No, it's a mixture of both. And Marcy, these things rarely are about just about money. Even on a spending bill like a continuing resolution or a debt bill, it's never just about money. It's ideological and it's philosophical. And this was the same mixture of both. And it does go far beyond the money because, you know, something else has to happen here at the end of the summer or into the fall that everybody really cares a lot about: comprehensive immigration reform. Mm-hmm. And when you see a situation like happened on the House floor yesterday, where John Boehner didn't have nearly the votes to pass a bill that a lot of people want to pass. In fact, farmers across the country, not to mention 47 million people on food stamps, need this bill to pass. When they couldn't put together the votes to do it the second time around, then you start to wonder. We already know that the Senate bill that's on the floor right now for immigration reform cannot pass the House with Republican support. That means they have to come up with another plan, and they're going to have to pass something eventually with a coalition of Democrats and Republicans. If a farm bill that people across the country support, that always usually passes every 5 years without too much trouble, falters and falls on its face on the House floor, and that's easy to pass, what's going to happen with ideologically driven bills like comprehensive immigration reform? Is there a way to get it done? And that's the question people are asking themselves this morning.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned immigration, because in the Senate yesterday, we saw evidence of a hard-fought bipartisan compromise. In fact, they did hammer out a bill that they felt that Republicans and Democrats could agree on. So we see movement in one House and not in the other?
Well, the Senate has always been an easier place for compromise. It's designed to be a little bit easier. The House is not a compromising body. It's designed for a majority rule. So there is that. The Senate is much more moderate than the House right now. But don't speak too soon about that compromise that you described on border security. It hasn't even been technically introduced yet. Yes, yeah. A lot of people are saying good things, but it won't be up until a vote next week. And I'm not making any bets until they get that thing passed.
Yeah, we're going to talk more about that next week, because there are quite some interesting little agreements that they've put in there.
Yep.
Well, a big question now. You mentioned the, you know, more than 100 million people on food stamps and all the farmers. What happens to them?
Well, 47 million people on food stamps at some point around the year. That's fine. Well, nobody really knows exactly what happens. It's back to the drawing board for sure, but it's unclear what the path forward is here. The current farm bill expires on September 30th, when current farm policy, crop insurance and different forms of subsidies, direct payments, when all that stuff expires. Now, you're worried about people on food stamps, and you should be. That's a separate authorization. So even if they don't reach an agreement by September 30th, that program won't expire right away. They still do need an agreement. It's not clear how the House and Senate are going to negotiate here and get something done, but all the appropriate powerful people and chairmen say they're going to get back to it and try to get something passed. I can't tell you exactly how that's going to happen right now.
I know you're in Washington, D.C. How do you think that the defeat of a farm bill is going to resonate for these lawmakers in their home districts?
Well, it depends on the kind of district, of course, and if you're a farm state, you know, heavily rural member of Congress, it resonates heavily, but it's also very parochial district by district, because what you also saw in a lot of this was different industries played off of each other for their subsidy programs. Dairy versus sugar, commodities versus businesses that use commodities, like the restaurants and the grocery store chains, they want commodities cheap, right? While the farmers want them more expensive.
Sure.
And all these things play off each other. It depends on who rules in your district, alfalfa growers and beet farmers or corn guys and ranchers. You know, it really depends.
Wow. Fascinating time. Who knew that the farm bill was so fascinating?
Well, I hope you I did. Made it. They need to solve a major problem here. Yeah. And people are really worried about what this means for immigration.
Todd Zwillich, thanks so much for taking time to explain it to us.
Anytime, Marcy.
Todd Zwillich is Washington correspondent for The Takeaway. That show airs at 1 o'clock Mondays through Thursdays here on KUOW.
It's 9:15. Today is the first day of summer, and tomorrow night, if it's clear, we'll see the biggest full moon of the year. That and more from the world of science in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Northwest Woodworkers Gallery, Seattle's wood art cooperative since 1980. Handcrafted woodwork, custom design, and fine furniture by local artisans. Located at First and Lenora and nwwoodgallery.com. Exquisite craftsmanship, innovative design.
57 degrees in Seattle under a mostly cloudy sky, expecting a chance of showers today. Tomorrow, though, Saturday, mostly sunny with a high of 74. It's 9:16. I'm Bernard Ouellette. A conversation with legendary American entertainer Stan Freberg, just 15 minutes away.
From 94.9 KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. This year, we've been exploring new scientific and technological research, and today we welcome back NBC News science editor Alan Boyle. And Alan, for those of us who like to gaze at the stars, theoretically tomorrow the weather's going to be clear, and that's great news for for moon lovers, I suppose.
Well, it's great news for anybody who wants to see cool things in the sky.
And what are we going to see tomorrow?
It's the supermoon. This is the weekend of the supermoon that every 14 months or so, the moon is in such a position in its orbit that it's closer to Earth than at any other time when it's full. And so it'll be bigger and brighter than any other moon, any other full moon this year.
Is this what we used to call a harvest moon when I was a kid?
Well, harvest moon really has to do with time of year. This is something that has to do with the moon's position in orbit, and a lot of people make a big deal out of it, say, you know, the tides are going to be big. Some people will say it's the most wonderful celestial event of the year. It's not that great, but it's a good it's a good opportunity to really look up into the sky. A lot of us don't get in the habit of seeing what's out there. And so especially we're so close to the solstice that the moon is expected to be relatively low in the sky. And there's something called the moon illusion that makes the moon look bigger than usual when it's close to the horizon.
So theoretically nice weather. Everybody's going to be celebrating. It's a Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect for
the stars are aligned.
Right. We need that Van Morrison song, Moon Dance. Well, let's jump from the moon to Mars. And I, you know, it's interesting. There are a lot of talk about NASA and its various missions, because I guess Congress is looking to reauthorize NASA.
Well, you go through the budget process every year, and it seems like every year nowadays people are wondering what the heck is NASA up to. And so we're going through that season right now.
What is NASA up to?
Right now the plan is to go get a piece of an asteroid and bring it back so that astronauts can look at it in the mid-2020s.
Where is this asteroid that they want to bring back?
Well, that's a good question. Nobody really knows yet. In fact, that's one of the issues, is that they haven't really found an asteroid that completely fills the bill yet.
Oh, I see. It's just a theoretical asteroid that
they
want to bring back?
Well, that it's a good idea to do this because we want to know what these things are like in case we need to blow one of them up like Bruce Willis did in Armageddon. But
I like that.
The idea is that you identify an asteroid that's not too big, not too small, and then bring it in the vicinity of the moon so that it can be studied. And we will also learn how to go to faraway places in the solar system by doing that.
I understand that the Republicans who are on a subcommittee that is reauthorizing NASA funding are not too keen on the asteroid idea.
No. The asteroid idea has not really caught fire, so to speak. And so people are talking about, well, maybe we should go back to the moon, or maybe we should just skip all this stuff and go right to Mars. And everyone agrees that eventually you want to go to Mars.
Well, in the Republican authorization bill, they want, and this is a quote, a sustained human presence on the moon and Mars.
Mm-hmm.
What is that?
Well, that's a moon base. And we went through that before during the Bush administration. That's what we were going to do, is put a big moon base on the moon and get into the science fiction movie era.
Wait, isn't that what Newt Gingrich was proposing?
Exactly. Newt Gingrich said, I'm going to put a moon base there on 2020. And Mitt Romney said, if anyone suggested that to me, I would fire him. And so this idea may get about that far this time around as well.
But a lot of people would like to see exploration to Mars and beyond.
Sure. That Mars is, you know, the hot ticket. And so everyone is trying to figure out, well, how do we learn how to do that? And that's the issue, is that you need to practice before you take the big trip.
And that doesn't necessarily making a sustained human presence.
Not necessarily. In fact, they had a hearing a couple of days ago, and one of the top scientists on Mars exploration, Steve Squires, said neither the asteroid nor the moon really does what you want to do.
We're talking with Alan Boyle of NBC News. I want to go back to asteroids just a second. A local company, a Seattle-based company or Seattle area company, has successfully crowdsourced funding for a telescopic asteroid hunting device.
Right, it's a space telescope. Basically, it's a little. It's kind of like remember when computers used to have to fill a room, and then all of a sudden you've got a computer on your desk.
Yes,
it's like that. This is a cool little space telescope project, and a company called Planetary Resources has been working on these telescopes as the first step to identify asteroids that you could mine and bring cool stuff back from.
So NASA needs to go to these these folks because they're more likely to be able to raise the money than Congress is to give NASA the money. These folks raised $1 million.
$1 million. That sounds like a lot of money, but it's going to take $10 million to build this telescope. But
on Kickstarter?
On Kickstarter. And the idea is that this $1 million is going to go toward being able to do cool things like having people sign up to take pictures of whatever they want to take a picture of. In fact, they have something called space selfies where they'll flash a little picture of yourself and then take that picture with Earth in the background, and you can put that on your Facebook page.
I just think it's a hilarious model, and it seems like that's where we're going as public funding dries up. We're not talking about $10 million yet, but who knows?
Yeah, you're going to see a lot of these Kickstarter projects for space-related. We're going to have more stories about this as the weeks go on.
Now, on the area of sort of great technology that's in your pocket, Bill Nye, the Science Guy, can now be in your pocket.
He's got an app. Yeah.
He's got his own app. This is the 20th anniearof
yeah,
Bill Nye's appearance?
Can you believe it?
No.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
No.
Uh-huh.
So who is the smartphone app aimed at?
Well, it's really aimed at kids. And that's the whole idea, is that Bill is all about inspiring the next generation of people who are going to save the world. or change the world is his catchphrase. So it includes clips from the shows and little games you can play on your smartphone. But Bill is, you know, he's really, he's the same as ever, as enthusiastic as ever, really fun guy.
In your article, you compared him to Mr. Science or Mr. Wizard.
Yeah.
And that's somebody
mm-hmm.
I grew up watching ask Mr. Wizard, who would do various experiments. And maybe there'll be somebody after Bill Nye, the Science Guy, but right now He fills that niche, maybe with Carl
Actually,
Sagan.
There are a lot of, like Neil deGrasse Tyson from the Hayden Planetarium is another guy like that. So it's heartening to see that it used to be that you were kind of stigmatized if you were a scientist who was involved in public engagement. But now it's pretty cool to see that these are the rock stars of the science world.
Yeah, it's wonderful. We're going to go from people in the heavens down to archaeology, which is science in itself. An ancient Cambodian megacity was discovered, actually a couple of them. But I'm interested, but the first one was discovered using what I say it, LIDAR. I'm not sure how they say it, LIDAR.
Yeah, that's it. Mm-hmm.
And it's something that geologists are using to do topographical research for earthquakes here in this region. But this is a city that's it's just a little bit north of Angkor Wat, and it's
actually,
very cool.
It turns out when the paper was released, we find out that Angkor Wat and this complex called Mahendra Parvata, which I love saying.
Good. Because I don't.
It is all part of this big megacity. And if you look at the LIDAR imagery, it looks like downtown New York.
Right. It's absolutely lined up geometric blocks.
Right. What happened? That's what people are wondering about.
Well, it sounds as if they think it was sort of deforestation, all the things that people warn about now.
Yeah.
They cut
mm-hmm.
down all the vegetation and things went to heck.
Uh-huh. The theory is that they got too big for their britches, and then all of a sudden a big climate crisis came along, a series of droughts, and they couldn't sustain that. And then all of a sudden, hundreds of years later, it's folded back into the jungle, which is kind of a scary thought.
Well, I think it's happened in South America as well, hasn't it?
Well, yeah. As a matter of fact, there's a new lost city that just came to light on Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula called Chactun, which was found using a slightly different technology where they look at aerial photographs stereoscopically, and then they can kind of get the overall image and see that there were structures there one time.
I'm assuming that archaeologists either suspected or knew that something had been, some sort of civilization had been in these places that they're scoping.
Mm, yeah, I mean it's a hot area for archaeology, but this particular area, they didn't know that there was anything there until they looked at the aerial photographs with basically a 3D eye.
What had them going up in the air to make these photographs in the
first place?
Actually,
it's interesting that this imagery was collected 15 years ago just to monitor what was happening to the forest land in the Yucatan Peninsula. And it just so happened that this researcher from Slovenia took this imagery and took a second look at it in 3D, and these structures came to light.
Well, it's interesting. So this idea of the we find these places, we look at.
There's a lost city every month, it seems.
But what was really astonishing to me, I haven't seen the pictures of the Yucatan Peninsula, but the pictures of Cambodia, we're talking about a big civilization that was highly organized that just is gone, which is really fascinating. So it sounds as if in places that have a lot of recorded history, we could be using this technology or looking at some of these stereoscopic images or LIDAR images and finding traces of things that we never even imagined were there in the first place?
Yeah, even in America, there was a huge civilization. There have been books written about Cahokia and the Mississippian civilization that built pyramids, and all this stuff kind of got swept aside as the civilization dwindled. And in the case of the Native American civilization, it's thought that when settlers came from Europe, they brought diseases with them. Yeah. And basically the diseases outpaced the explorers, so that by the time the explorers came there, they saw nothing and they assumed that there were just these primitive people living there.
So now that we have increasingly new fancy technologies, we're going to see maybe more marriages of archaeologists used to be theoretical, or else the sort of, Harrison.
Indiana Jones wearing the fedora with the machete.
So now it's going to be people looking at computer imagery saying, oh, once upon a time there was a civilization in this spot.
Well, it starts with the guy at the computer or the girl at the computer, but eventually you do have to take the machete and hack your way through to find the stuff.
Oh, good, because I would hate to have that romance.
Indiana will still have a job.
And then once they get to wherever mega lost city they find, tomorrow night at least, they can look up into the sky and just contemplate the beauty of the moon.
Wow.
Isn't that romantic?
What can I say to that?
Well, I'm excited to look at the moon and dancing stars and think about Mars and think about these ancient cities. So thanks for bringing these stories to us.
Good. Glad to do it.
Alan Boyle is a science editor for NBC News Online, and you can find links to these stories. And then there's a really cool picture of Mars on there, which it's radio, so we can't show it to you. So you're going to have to look online yourself. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
This is Weekday.
Stan Freberg is an American satirist, voice actor, comedian, and radio personality whose career began in 1944. He's 86 years old now, and he's still kicking around. In fact, he just kicked his way into KUOW, so we're going to take the opportunity to talk to him about his amazing life. And we're going to do that 1 minute from now on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
KUOW would like to thank the members of the Broadcasters Circle for their generosity and leadership support throughout the year. For more information on how you can become a Broadcasters Circle member, visit KUOW.org.
Cloudy in Seattle and 56 degrees. Forecast says we should expect clouds through the day, continuing chance of showers, and an afternoon high of 65. Things are going to change overnight, though. Tomorrow, Saturday, we're looking at lots of sun and a high in the mid-70s.
Support for KUOW comes from Metropolitan Market's Local Tastes Best event. Metropolitan Market's butchers are in store 7 days a week to provide custom cuts of all prime and choice grade Northwest beef. More about local ranchers and varieties of Northwest beef at metropolitan-market.com.
Our families are so open to us. They accept us the way we are.
Daniel's from Brazil. He and husband James married in New York. A Supreme Court ruling could determine whether Daniel can stay in the U.S. or whether he has to go.
The thing that pulls us through 6 years ago or now is that we're very strong people who love each other very much.
Their story next time on The World.
And you can hear that later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, which airs from 3 to 7 p.m. today. It's 9:31. I'm Bernard Ouellet. Jeffrey Skilling, one-time CEO of Enron, was sentenced to 24 years in prison for his role in the collapse of Enron. Now he could see his sentence reduced by 10 years. More about that in 30 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. When I was young, back in the olden days of the mid-20th century, my mother used to listen to comedy recordings, and there was one in particular that she really loved.
Stan Freberg modestly presents the United States of America.
That's humorist, satirist, and ad man Stan Freberg. His career started in the 1940s. It spanned almost seven decades. Stan Freberg's been honored with a star on Hollywood's Walk of Fame. He's won Emmy Awards and 21 Clio Awards, which prompted Advertising Age magazine to call Stan Freberg the father of the funny commercial. Stan Freberg and his wife, Hunter Freberg, are with us in the studios. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
I played that because my mother is a huge fan of yours, but this is the tape that really etched you in my mind. I'm from Michigan, so you'll understand why.
Radio? Why should I advertise on radio? There's nothing to look at, no pictures.
Listen, you can do things on radio you couldn't possibly do on TV.
That'll be the day.
All right, watch this. Okay, people, and now when I give you the cue, I want the 700-foot mountain of whipped cream to roll into Lake Michigan, which has been drained and filled with hot chocolate. Then the Royal Canadian Air Force will fly overhead towing a 10-ton maraschino cherry, which will be dropped into the whipped cream to the cheering of 25,000 extras. All right, cue the mountain. Cue the Air Force. Maraschino cherry. Okay, 25,000 cheering extras.
Now, you want to try that on television?
Well...
You see, radio is a very special medium because it stretches the imagination.
Doesn't television stretch the imagination?
Up to 27 inches, yes.
Well, as a radio person, you can see why I like that one.
I love that whole spot.
Now, what did you make that for originally? It wasn't an ad itself, was it?
No, it was for...
The Radio Advertising Bureau.
The Radio Advertising Bureau.
And people loved it, I'm
R-A-B,
sure.
R.A.B., yeah.
It's so famous now.
Yeah, yes, it is. One of the most... I think that's the most famous thing that the Radio Advertising Bureau says is requested.
Well, it just shows the power that radio can have, because you can hear it in your mind, you can see it in your mind's eye, something that you couldn't do on TV. I was curious when you first fell in love with radio.
Well, I was a fan as a child. I listened to the Fred Allen Show and a lot of other shows, and I just became a fan of radio, you know.
I read that you got hired right out of high school almost to do voiceover work.
Yes, I did. Yeah. Well, that's the bus story.
Yeah. You want to tell me that story? Or Hunter, do you want to tell the story?
Yeah, actually, I'll do a shortened version of this. I used to be an executive search consultant with a big international firm. And as a headhunter, I heard a lot of stories about careers. But when my husband told me this career when we were dating, I said, I haven't heard a better career story. He received a scholarship to Stanford, and that's where he was going to go in the fall. But he decided that he wanted to break into show business. So he took a bus from Pasadena to Hollywood. And his father was a Baptist minister. So his father said, "Now, you know, Stan, Hollywood can be a tough place. So be sure you're back before dark and you be careful." And his mother packed him a little lunch and so that he'd be all well taken care of. So he takes the bus in, and finally he's the last person on the bus. And the bus driver says to him, "Kid, where do you want to get off?" And he says, "I want to get off in the middle of Hollywood." And he goes, "Psst." And he slams on the brakes and says, "Kid, this is as middle as it gets." And it was Hollywood Boulevard and Whittlesey, I believe.
Whittlesey. Whitley.
Right. Okay. So Freeberg gets off and he walks into this building on the corner there, and he's looking. There's an Orange Julius place. Okay. So he can have a little drink with his lunch, and he sees the directory, and the directory says Invisible Weaving, and then it says Talent Agency, Stars of Tomorrow. And he thinks,
That's me.
That you were the star of tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah.
So now he gets in the elevator.
Yeah, I get in the elevator. Creaky elevator. And I went up and I walked in, and this little Jewish guy with a cigar and a woman with the big shoulder pads like Eve Arden came out and talked to me. They said, yes, can we help you? I said, yes, I'd like some representation. I don't know where I got that word at 18, you know. But anyhow, they said, what do you do? I said, well, I do various voices. I said, like what? I said, well, like FDR, Franklin Roosevelt. Yesterday, December 7th, a day that will live in infamy. And Jimmy Durante, everybody wants to get into the act. And that's all, folks. So now she says, okay, let's all hold hands and pray. So as a preacher's son, I thought, well, that's interesting. This must be the way they start off every day at William Morris. So anyhow.
So the woman then says, okay, let's all hold hands and pray. And then she says, dear God, I want you to bless this young man, Stan.
Freeberg, I said, straightening it out for the Lord.
That he will have a great career and blah, blah, blah. So she calls a man named John Burton at Warner Brothers. And she says to John, I have this very talented young man here. I want to bring him over. And then she says, I know you have Mel Blanc, but Mel Blanc cannot do all of the characters out there. So she puts Freeberg in the car, takes him to Warner Brothers, and he goes through the same thing, doing the voices. And then John Burton goes, stop. And Freeberg thinks, oh, no, I'm bombing. And then the guy says, can you come back tomorrow and do this for all of our animators? So Freeberg takes the bus home, dreams of Looney Tunes in his head, takes the bus back to Warner Brothers the next day. They put him behind a screen because they don't want to see him. They only want to hear the voices. So here is Chuck Jones, Bugs Bunny. Here is Fritz Freleng, Pink Panther, all that. And Freeberg is nervous as can be. You know, he's 18 years old, just graduated high school. He does the voices, and then he hears them all laughing and applauding. And so they ask him to come out, and then every one of them had a job for him. Okay, fabulous. So the next week he has a SAG card. But the wonderful part of it was that when, as they put their arms around him and had this character and that character and different jobs and so forth, Fritz Freleng looks up at him and says,
why haven't we heard of you before, Stan? I said, I don't know. I've been around, you know. He said, oh, I didn't mean that the way it sounded. I mean, I'm sure you didn't just get off the bus.
Which is exactly what he did. Oh, we're talking. Let me just say who you are again. Stan Freeberg, Hunter Freeberg. And boy, you guys have stories galore, don't you?
Yeah, we certainly do. Yeah. Never a dull, more boring moment in this marriage.
I'm going to play a little clip from a film that a lot of our listeners probably know. This is the role of Stan playing the role of the beaver in Lady and the Tramp.
Yeah. Say, you mind if I slip it on for size?
Help yourself, Rand. Help yourself.
Okay. Don't mind if I do. How do you get the corn-starty thing off, sonny?
I always was curious, listening to Beaver, how you got that whistle in your voice.
Well, I actually use a sound effects man friend of mine, Jimmy McDonald, said, hold a police whistle right in front of your mouth, and every time you hit an S, you know, the police whistle will help you out, yeah.
But that was actually Walt Disney's idea,
yeah.
Because when Stan sat down to do it, they said, hold on, Walt's going to come down and direct you himself, Stan.
Yeah.
He did? Walt came down and directed you?
Yeah, I was ready to start, and they said, hold it, Stan, Walt's coming down, he wants to direct you himself. So he came down, and morning, Stan, morning, Walt. And
did you know him already?
No, never.
That was it.
In my life, yeah. And the interesting thing was that nowadays they'd say they want you to come out and audition for the part of the beaver. But he just knew I'd be perfect for the beaver, so So that was it.
That was 55 or 56, I think. Am I right about that?
Yeah.
At the same time you were doing these voiceovers, I should say, audience, if you don't know Stan Freberg's work, or you think you don't, you do, because he's everywhere. I mean, you were working all the time. It seems like you got hooked up with Capitol Records. And you guys want to tell me how that happened? You're doing satire. Great piece. Maybe we should hear this is from, I think, the first recording on Capitol, John and Marcia.
Yeah.
John. Marcia. John?
Marcia.
John.
Marcia.
John.
Marcia.
John.
Marcia.
John.
Marcia.
Oh, John.
Stan Freberg's recording for Capitol Records, 1951, John and Marcia.
That's the first record I made for Capitol.
And how do you pitch a record like that? What did you tell them?
Well, a friend of mine was the country star Cliffy Stone. And so he took me into Capitol and said it's a very unusual recording that he wants to do. And they told Ken Nelson, was my A&R guy at Capitol. I said, doesn't he ever say anything but John and Marcia? And he said, well, no, that's a joke.
Well, it's been picked up, I have to say. Did the producers of Mad Men call you?
Well, it was really funny. We were entertaining at Comic-Con that year, and one of the reporters came up to us, and they said, do you know for the new season of Mad Men that Matthew is doing a shout-out to Freberg? And we hadn't known that. But it was interesting because we had met Matthew, and Matthew was interested in Freberg doing a guest shot sometime, you know. And we were laughing because actually we did hear, too, that he was going to possibly have Don Draper in the show in his 80s. So we were laughing. We'd go, oh, would that be perfect for Freberg to show up, you know, for the closing season of Mad Men? It would be wonderful.
Well, so that you live in probably three generations past when you actually recorded John and Marcia in the first place.
Oh, yeah, right. That's right.
Did Capitol give you free rein to do whatever you wanted?
Yeah. Hmm.
We're going to listen to, I think, maybe the most famous of the parodies for Capitol. It was a spoof of Dragnet. It was called St. George and the Dragonette. And this actually was number one on the Billboard charts for 3 weeks in 1953. Here's a clip.
The legend you are about to hear is true. Only the needle should be changed to protect the record.
This is the countryside. My name is St. George. I'm a knight. Saturday, July 10th, 8:05 p.m. I was working out of the castle on the night watch when a call came in from the chief. A dragon had been devouring maidens. Homicide. My job. Slay him. You call me, chief?
Yeah, it's the dragon again, devouring maidens. The king's daughter may be next.
Mm-hmm. You got a lead?
Nothing much to go on. Said you take that .45 automatic into the lab to have him check on it?
Yeah, you were right.
I was right?
Yeah, it was a gun.
That's from St. George and the Dragonette. Did the folks at Dragnet get upset about
it? As a matter of fact, Jack Webb said, as I came walking up to him where he was shooting at Universal, I think, and he said, I was wondering when you were finally going to get around to me.
So you cast your net pretty wide. I mean, nobody was spared your parody.
No, that's right.
Nobody was spared. This is politics in a very subtle way. This is from a piece called Little Blue Riding Hood, also in the Dragnet theme.
Yeah.
The story of Little Blue Riding Hood is true. Only the color has been changed to prevent an investigation.
Did you ever get dinged for your political satire?
No, not that I can think of. But by the way, that was June Foray. My friend June Foray, the wonderful, who's 92 years old now. Did a little Blue Riding Hood.
It's a great voice.
Yeah.
In advertising, which you were involved in, you went after that as well. This is from 1958, and this is a piece that I know your father was fond of. This is from Green Christmas.
Ah, humbug, everybody.
Good morning, Mr. Scrooge.
Well, the meeting will come to order, if you please. Are all the advertising people represented here?
Everyone except amalgamated cheese.
Well, if they're not here for the Christmas pitch, I can't help them find new ways of tying their product into Christmas. That's why I'm chairman of this board. Let's hear it for me.
Hear, hear, hear!
Stan Freberg from Green Christmas 1958 recording, which initially people were leery about that running, right?
Well, Capitol was were because they thought it was sort of anti-business.
And, well, it was.
It was in a way, yeah, but it was an attack on the over-commercialization of Christmas is what I had in mind. And my father, who was a minister, of course, loved that record. It's too bad you couldn't play a little more of it.
Yeah, you know, I was just going to say, too, along with that, we had a wonderful story. There was a restaurant called Dupar's that was right next to the Capitol Tower. And so Freberg has always wanted very original, creative things. And they gave him a toy cash register to use in Green Christmas. He says, no, I want the real thing.
I'm a national cash register.
Okay. So knowing Freberg's creativity, he took one of the people that he worked with at Capitol next door to Dupar's. And he said, I'm going to go over there and get a national cash register. And, of course, they all thought he was crazy, okay? So he goes in, and it's the end of the day at Dupar's, and he says to the cashier,
I need that cash register. Now the guy puts his hands in the air. I said, no, you don't understand. I need the sound of that cash register. So the manager came out. I said, I'm Stan Freberg. You know me? He said, I heard of you. So I said, I just want to borrow that cash register for about 10 minutes. I had to give him my driver's license, my
watch,
my Rolex watch, and two or three other things.
And then they put the cash register on the dolly and rolled right back to Capitol and recorded it.
My A&R man, Ken Nelson, couldn't believe that I pulled that off. So now it goes, jingle bell chikung, jingle bell chikung, jingle all the way, and then the door slams shut. So now as we're walking back with the cash register, my sound effects guy says, working with you, Freberg, is like working with nobody else. And so then he gave me my watch back and everything.
Good to know that you got that driver's license back. Stan Freberg and Hunter Freberg are with us here on KUOW. So you had this satire, you did live radio, you were doing voiceover, and you also started in the advertising industry itself. And when did that start? Do you remember?
Well, Howard Gossage, my friend in San Francisco, asked me one day, what do you think of advertising? I said, I hate most of it. He says, just the man we want. So I had me record for his client, Considine Foods. And I wrote the song. Who puts eight great tomatoes in that little bitty can? Who puts eight great tomatoes in that little bitty can? Who puts eight great tomatoes in that little bitty can? You know who, you know who, you know who. And the announcer says, in case you don't, it's Contadina tomato paste.
And then the president of Contadina, when they asked, why did you go with Freberg? He said, because it didn't sound like advertising.
It didn't sound like normal advertising.
Now, we're going to play a clip. This is a commercial for Sunsweet Prunes.
Yeah.
You are looking at Mr. Ray Bradbury, distinguished science fiction author of Fahrenheit 451 and The Martian Chronicles, who has said, by the year 2001, man will travel about in pneumatic people tubes, his television wall to wall, and most incredible of all, his Sunsweet pitted prunes carried in tiny mini packs.
Hold it! What's going on here?
Pardon me?
I never mentioned prunes in any of my stories.
Oh, you didn't?
No, never. I'm sorry to be so candid.
No, they're not candid, but pretty sweet all the same. The prune of tomorrow, available now.
They're still rather badly wrinkled, though.
SunSweet's wrinkle technicians will one day conquer that, too. SunSweet marches on.
They don't even call them prunes anymore. They call them dried plums now. I mean,
yeah.
No, Ray Bradbury was a friend of yours.
He was not only a friend, he was best man at my wedding with Hunter.
So he didn't hesitate to step in and advertise prunes for you?
Who?
Bradbury? He didn't. No, just said, hey, I need you to be in this commercial?
Yeah, yeah. No, I said, I need you to be in this commercial.
And he said, sure.
Sure.
He didn't even know what, did he know it was prunes?
Yeah.
Yeah, so he was fine with that.
He was fine with it, yeah.
How much time did you actually spend in the advertising industry?
Oh.
Years, right?
Yeah, decades.
Enough to win 21 Clio's.
21 Clio Awards.
The Oscar of advertising.
What was it about advertising that was fun for you?
I wanted to improve it. Before Stan Freberg, there was no humor in advertising. So I wanted to put, I'm the guy that put humor into advertising.
And did any of the companies that you were hired to advertise, they knew what they were getting?
Yeah, of course.
So they never said, okay, they never, you brought them something and they never all went,
no.
Oh, wait, that's going four or five steps too far, Stan Freberg.
No, they all love what I did.
You know, you have, I don't even have the list. There's lists, you can go to Wikipedia and they've got links to all these ads, dozens and dozens of ads. In your mind, what's the one that you're proudest of? The ad that you're happiest that you did?
What would you say, Hunter?
Well, he loved the SunSweet one. And what was great about that, the Wall Street Journal gave him a column one first page article talking about that the sales went up 400%. So after his advertising campaign. So that's not a bad track record.
No, that's pretty good.
And then he had a fabulous one for Gino Pellucci was the client in Duluth. And he had which very aptly is perfect timing now with the movie coming out, The Lone Ranger. And he actually had Clayton Moore and Jay Silver for Tonto in this wonderful one for Gino's pizza rolls.
Pizza rolls.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it was Tonto who had the pizza rolls in his pocket, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, right.
Well, this is an encyclopedia for people who grew up in the 1990s. You remember commercials for Encyclopedia Britannica. This one featured your son, Donovan.
Yeah, right.
On screen.
Right.
So let's hear some of that.
Well, since this has turned out to be a Britannica commercial, I guess you're going to tell me how somebody could get a set.
Actually, I thought I might, yeah.
And I suppose you're going to throw one of those 800 numbers up on the screen. Am I right?
Might as well.
And there it is.
To find out how you can own the Encyclopedia Britannica, just call this toll-free number and we'll send you this free booklet telling you everything you need to know about your key to the information age.
Yeah.
Your son, didn't he would just do what you asked him to also?
Yeah.
Hunter, were you in any of these?
Young actor. No.
Okay.
She wasn't married to me.
We hadn't met at that time.
But you would have done these ads.
I would have done those with pleasure.
So it sounds like life together is, you mentioned never a dull moment, but this is now a dual act. It's no longer one Freberg, it's two Freebergs.
Yeah.
Well, we are so lucky. We entertain as two funny Freebergs, two brains in love, or two creative Freebergs, depending on who our client is. And we always laugh and we say, you know, we have the ability, both of us, to drive somebody crazy. So it's so good that we married each other and that we get along. We decided to go out to breakfast early one morning, and so he decided to check out these different restaurants as I drove. We went to five different places. First one, no, the decor isn't right. Second one, no, nobody interesting there. Until like the fifth one, which was perfect. I said, do you know how many people, too many other spouses would have killed you, if you wouldn't have made a decision after the first one. But what I find interesting, one of the many things I find interesting about him, is that we have always been on the same wavelength from day one when we met, that we didn't have to explain to each other who somebody was or backgrounds. We love to read. We love music. I was a music minor in college. I mean, all of these different things that we just automatically had in common.
It's wonderful to hear about two people having such a good time throughout their lives together. Stan Freberg's the first volume, I think you're working on a second, first volume of his autobiography is called It Only Hurts When I Laugh. You are working on a second volume?
Yes. We're working on two different books.
Okay. Well, we'll look forward to those. Hunter Freberg, Stan Freberg.
Do I have time to tell a Lawrence Welk story?
Can you tell it really quickly? Yeah, sure. They say yes.
Yes, okay.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
I was going with one of the champagne ladies at the time at the Aragon Ballroom, and so they said, look, is this Stan Freberg? They told Lawrence Welk. I said, okay. Here is a Stan Freeman. They said, Freeberg. He said, come out here and do whatever it is you do. So I came out. And anyhow, later the champagne lady told me as he's waltzing with her, he said to her, smile, damn you, smile, you know. And so that's encouraged me to do the record, Wonderful, Wonderful. And he said, say, Freeberg. I never say wonderful, wonderful. I said, well, Lawrence, it seems to me that you do. No. It's, what did he call his book when he came out? Wonderful, Wonderful, with my spelling, W-U-N-N-E-R apostrophe E-L.
When you think back, I mean, you can think ahead. You're writing these books, but, you know, there's these memories of 7 decades of this business. Was there ever a bad moment?
No, not that I can think of. No. And I don't know if I told you, when I was doing the Beaver for the Lady and the Tramp, they said, hold it, Stan. Walt's coming down. He wants to direct you himself. Yeah.
But see, for him, you know, there's probably no one out there today that has had many great careers and worked with Sinatra, you know, all these different top people. It's fabulous for him. So he feels very lucky that God's been very good to him.
And we feel really lucky that we've had the benefit of all the many things that you've done. Stan Freeberg and Hunter Freeberg, thank you so much for coming in today.
Yeah, our pleasure.
Thank you.
You're listening to Weekday on 94.9 KUOW Seattle. I'm Marcy Silman. Coming up after 10 o'clock, weather and our journalist roundtable.
It's 9:59. Looks like they could make beer again in the former Olympia Brewery building in Tumwater. Lisa Brooks has that in the news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Hear popular music of the 1920s through the 1950s from sweet to hot on the Swing Years and Beyond. I'm Amanda Wilde, your host for 5 hours of the best music from the first half of the last century on The Swing Years, Saturday nights, 7 to midnight on 94.9 KUOW.
Support for KUOW comes from the Washington Academy of Languages, a division of CityU, providing foreign language learning opportunities to the Seattle community since 1979. Learn more online at wal.org.
Come on and talk to me.
Singer Yarla Bernhoft builds his songs. First one layer, then another. Culminating in a soulful sound straight out of Norway.
I've been thinking a lot since the end of a family affair.
Bernhoft plays in studio Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Sunday morning on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Every day, KUOW's news and information programs dig deep into issues and stories that are important to you. And it's your... Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.